Hello and welcome to another episode of Soundstage Access, a podcast that brings you in depth to discuss many of the complex, beautiful, and creative sides of filmmaking. I'm your host, Brando Benetton, and my guest this week is Dariusz Wolski, an Oscar-nominated Polish cinematographer whose credits include Ridley Scott's The Martian, Prometheus and House of Gucci, Tim Burton's Sweeney Todd and Alice in Wonderland, the first four Pirates of the Caribbean movies, as well as the upcoming Napoleon, starring Joaquin Phoenix. In today's conversation, the 67-year-old and I discuss his experience on the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, shooting the second and third movie simultaneously and often out of order. His time on the controversial 2017 film All the Money in the World, which scrambled to replace Kevin Spacey with a new performance by Christopher Plummer, shooting brand new scenes just weeks from the film's global release. Also, the personal reason Dariusz chose not to be involved in Gladiator 2, and how him and Ridley Scott choreographed the larger-than-life battle scenes in the upcoming Napoleon movie. All of this and much more. If you enjoy Soundstage Access, you might want to hit that subscribe button to find all previous episodes. We'd love to ask you to support us by leaving a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. But now, without further ado, let's go to our conversation. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. I'm extremely excited. And I thought, you know, we could take things from the beginning. You began as a gaffer and an AC back in the early 80s before shooting music videos. I just loved hearing stories, by the way, about you cutting your own cinematography reel and removing shots of the band, artists like Elton John and Aerosmith, and you're just presenting your work as if you're shooting cinema already. And that was the great approach.
I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, it's true.
But I just listened to it in an interview.
Oh my God.
It's crazy because that decade of wide-ranging experiences, you were also shooting a lot of interviews. How did that decade function as the perfect training ground for your first few features once you became a cinematographer full-on?
It was like, first, I went to film school in Poland, which is very kind of, I would say, artsy, and everyone is an artist, and cinematographers are more important than anybody else. Actually, it's not true, because they have directing department and acting department, which is quite convenient, because when you make your student films, you have actors available, or you film shoot for directors. You know, they're all short exercise things. But you are raised up as a cinematographer and an artist. So I grew up on European movies, and the big influence were 70s American movies, you know, independent, you know, like, I mean, Godfather, but also French Connections and In Cold Blood, and, you know, all this movies that were like really dealing with reality and whatever the cultural revolution was going on in America. So I was always into the movies that had some content and meaning. I mean, to the point that the first time I saw Star Wars was 20 years after its release with my son, because we just didn't care, you know, like some guys with Nazi helmets painted white, just like that was just too fake. Even though, you know, later watching the movie, I do appreciate it for its impact at the time, and living in America, how it affected American society, and that, you know, spaceship going through canyons is the most visually attractive thing ever that's being repeated to death, and yeah, with better and better technology. But as a content, just it didn't inspire me at all. And aesthetically, it was kind of really great with the cartoonish and stuff. So that was my background. Yeah. So then I come to New York, I immigrate for whatever reasons, and reality starts. You know, you have all this lofty ideas, you educate on great paintings and European art, on artistic movies. And in the 80s, 1979, 80, the whole thing was gone, to the point that I remember people from Columbia University not knowing who Robert Altman was, which was like shocking. I'm from small Poland, and I know more about interesting Americans than kids whose parents are paying a lot of money to educate them, you know. So that was kind of a cultural shock. And another shock was just survival, you know. So obviously I had to humble up and just learn how to load cameras. And I mean, I knew them already because of film school. So I became a bit of a camera assistant, bit of gaffer. Just fortunate, I met somebody who was very kind and hooked me up with BBC. So I was doing a bit of lighting, bit of camera assisting. But I think whatever you do can be a preparation for your cinematographer. So if you work in any capacity, as long as you keep your eyes open and watch how things are done, it's always an exercise. You're always making your own movie in your mind. I mean, if you're serious about it. I mean, walking on New York streets, it's the most inspiring visual thing ever. It's you making your own movie constantly.
That's a great way to put it. And we'll talk about, you know, your more recent projects. In your entire career, there's so many we could pick from, but I'll jump ahead a number of years. This year marks the 20th anniversary of Pirates of the Caribbean.
20?
Yeah, this year is the...
Oh, God. I'm not going to start counting, but I guess it's true. You know better than
I mean, I see it as a way of celebrating, you know, as an excuse. And for people listening, just out of context, you shot the first four films between 2003 and 2011. Making these films is way harder than people imagine because you not only have weather, but you're shooting out at sea, remote locations. We talked to V. Neal, who was a department head back then, and she was talking about the fact that, you know, the makeup department had delays in supplies coming into the islands. And what I think is most fascinating, the reason I'm asking you about, you know, those projects is because you shot 2 and 3 at the same time. You were talking about the fact that you shot 269 days before you had to just leave and go shoot Sweeney Todd. And I was just wondering, for you, looking back now, how do you think those Pirates movies would have been different if you had shot them chronologically, perhaps with a break, you know, in a more traditional way?
Yeah, I would never recommend to shoot 2 movies in a row, no. Back to back, yeah. Would never recommend to anybody. It seems financially attractive because you think you build a set and you should, but creatively it's a nightmare. And it's funny, I did this small movie with Bob Zemeckis and we were reminiscing and he said, absolutely right, I would never, because he did 2 and 3 of Back to the Futures. And he said the same thing, I would never do this again, it's complete madness. I mean, you could do this with episodical television because it's kind of a formulaic and you kind of, once you get the rhythm, you can, but with the movie, it's tricky. But hey, we had a great opportunity. It was lots of fun. We did our best.
You have a debt to pay. You've been captain of the Black Pearl for 13 years. That was our agreement.
Technically, I was only captain for 2 years. Then I was viciously mutinied upon.
Then you were a poor captain, but a captain nonetheless. Have you not introduced yourself all these years as Captain Jack Sparrow?
Have my payment. One soul to serve on your ship is already over there.
One soul is not equal to another.
Aha! So we've established my proposal is sound in principle. Now we're just haggling over price.
You know, there's this great James Wan quote that says, if casting is half of directing, then location is half of cinematography.
That's true.
I thought I would ask you about Sweeney Todd because I think that it's unique in the sense that, from my understanding, it was shot mostly on backlots at Pinewood Studios. You had production designer Dante Ferretti rebuilding sometimes exterior city blocks of London inside sound stages.
Everything was inside.
Everything was inside. Well, what does that teach you about cheating outdoors for indoors? And what is the most that a practical location can offer you as a cinematographer?
Well, that's what I was saying at the beginning, that you always shoot your movie in your mind, you know? So then when you have a chance to recreate it on stage, you always go back. It's what it would look like if I was on real location. So the problem with the stage work that because you can, you know, you have the grid, you can put lights anywhere you want. Sometimes it becomes theatrical. My approach to it is always, what if I was in the real place? So Sweeney Todd was fully shot on stage. Dark City was fully shot on stage. Crow was, except one backlot at night, which had to be, was pretty much shot on stage. So I have a lot of experience of both, but I treat them exactly the same way, you know? It's always come from approach of what it would look like for real. If you were just with a still camera by yourself as a reportage photographer, you know.
I'm Mr. Sweeney Todd of Fleet Street. I have opened a bottle of Pirelli's Elixir, and I say to you that it is nothing but an errant fraud concocted from piss and ink. Yet I wager that I can shave a cheek with 10 times more dexterity than any street mountebank. you see these razors? I lay them against 5 pounds. You are no match, sir. Either accept my challenge or reveal yourself as a sham.
At this point, I would love to shift our conversation towards your relationship with Ridley Scott. For people listening, your experience with 3D and Alice in Wonderland and then Pirates 4 is what led Ridley to offer you the job on Prometheus, and you've been working together ever since. And about him, you had this to say, quote, "Ridley's best way to express his vision is simply to draw it. His storyboards are his train of thought," close quote.
Did I say that?
You did say that, and it's a fantastic quote.
That's pretty eloquent.
You know, I was very lucky in June of 2017. You definitely don't know this, but I was lucky enough to spend one day with you and Ridley on set for All the Money in the World. And I was mind blown watching you and Ridley at work in regards to the time it would take you to light a scene and then just get it quickly with multiple cameras. So in what ways do you think Ridley brings the best out of you as a cinematographer? And how do you guys select these angles to cover a scene when you're shooting with up to 4 cameras, which is what you were doing on that day?
Every day, yeah.
Mostly every day.
Well, it's still up to debate, you know, what is the best way to make a film? And nobody really has an answer, you know. And I would kind of categorize vaguely into 2 categories. One, that the camera by itself is a narrative. Like when you look at Polanski, when you look at Spielberg, they love to have a camera that just really tells you the story, but also forces you to see certain things. What Ridley does, he uses multiple cameras to, he sets an event. He sets an event, there's a rehearsal, there's stunt people, there's effects, whatever, or there's a dialogue, there's a performance, and he finds 4 best ways to capture it. It's like walking into the space, and that's what's happening. So how do I want to see it? I want to see it from here, from here, from here, and from here. And once he sets this up, then he creates the event that we photograph. And based on that, first of all, there's a lot of thinking about what angles are the best to tell the story. And then after that, if there's anything missing, you exactly know, I just want to punch it in a close-up here or there. But that's Ridley's way of thinking. And I took it as a challenge. I took it as a big challenge. And I think it improves your cinematography because you get to the point with enough experience, and you'll probably get there too, and everyone does. It's not that hard to make a picture because, you know, you put the front light, you put the back light, or you keep it silhouette, or you keep it brighter, you keep it side lit. I mean, it's like once you have this vocabulary, it's like playing music. I mean, it's like if you know how to play the melody, you can play the melody, but it's what you do with it. And with 4 cameras, you have all those restrictions, so you cannot put the light in. Of course, it would be nice to put the light here and have a beautiful, soft wrapping around light and maybe a little bounce. But you can't do this because you have all those cameras, so you have to really think hard. And because of those limitations, your photography becomes more interesting. Again, it's the same thing like you were a reportage photographer. You know, there's a bunch of guys who walk into the same room, whatever happens, and one guy has just got to notice something that nobody else has. You know, so he'll find an angle. It'll tell your emotions. You'll see the light. You'll see everything, composition. And he's not going to rearrange a woman with a baby or a wounded soldier. He's just going to find an angle. And that's the magic of cinema, you know. But because of Hollywood and requirements and 300 opinions, we can do whatever we want. And help of CG, of course.
I wanted to build more on that for a second. And just to create context for the quote I'm about to give you, you work with Tony Scott, Ridley's late brother. So this is what you have to say about what we're talking about, which is the simultaneous coverage. Quote, "Tony Scott shot coverage in one direction, so it felt easier. But Ridley shoots complementary, often cross-cutting, and he does that for the performance. He's not too precious and isn't afraid of silhouette. I'd never do that with any other director. As we always say, if something looks bad, it's documentary. If something looks good, it's stylized," close quote. But I think, as we were saying at the beginning, it's impossible when you're shooting with these many cameras to really craft, as you said, light for every single angle. But, you know, I study your films with Ridley, and I just think it's fascinating because I assume you have to favor long lenses to stay out of each other's way. There's no way of putting necessarily something in the middle. Maybe I'm wrong, you know, but...
You'll be surprised.
Really? Could I ask you a little more about that? You know, is it about some cameras having longer lenses and staying in the back and others being...
No, you stay, you know, like if you shoot wide, then you do wide coverage. You hardly go for a big close-up when you shoot something super wide. Now you have to, you know, we don't do that. That's, I mean, sometimes, but you know, you just shoot like a medium wide coverage and medium, and then you just bring those cameras closer if you want to go closer. Yeah. And you'll be amazed, like even with, I mean, the great thing about Ridley that actually is he used pretty standard lenses.
What do you mean by that?
You know, standard, which is like, you know, of course, sometimes there's 17 mil to be wide, but it's like between 21 and 75, you just say, that's it. So there's nothing extreme, you know. And, you know, once in a while, you pull out longer lenses, especially with big events, even when you have, you know, when you have like cavalry charging and, you know, explosions and stuff, when you have, you know, cameras on the cranes, super wide, then of course you... But then you still try to put the cameras inside the sack, you know, cover them with some boxes and stuff, you know.
Do you ever go beyond five? Aside from obviously big stunts.
No, just not at all. Normal like performance scenes. Actually, three, four cameras. Yeah. But when you go like to big battle scenes, then you just take everything you have. Yeah.
One of the things that struck me that day when I was watching your work is your relationship with camera operators on a take-to-take basis. And the way Ridley communicates with you, I wonder, how do you select your operators? How do you communicate to them to adjust from each take?
I'm super fortunate because my A camera operator with most of the Ridley films is an Italian, Daniele Mazzucchesi. So for him, it was the first time he was actually in Italy working. Pretty ironic because most of the movies we did all over the world, and mostly England. So it was his first movie in Italy with us. So he felt kind of responsible for Italians. I mean, I don't know what he was saying, but he was really tough on this. I mean, on all the money we had, we had good guys. But you have one operator who truly understands Ridley, you know. So he's like my extension, Ridley's extension. Because if you have operators to come from without working for Ridley, they're in complete shock when we tell them to put the camera here. So like, what do you mean? This camera's going to see it. Just put the camera, we'll sort it out. And then, like, week later, actually it works. They're completely in shock. So Daniele was indispensable. I mean, in all his movies, but especially in Italy, because he was just explaining to the guys, because not very few people are used to that, you know, especially in Europe, that most of the movies are, you know, much simpler in scale and scope. So Daniele was very, very important, kind of, you know, one extra person who is completely in sync with this, like three of us and really script supervisor Annie. It's like actually four of us just designing the whole thing. Because, you know, it gets complicated. You put cameras, you have an idea. Obviously, not all of it works in the first time, so you just have to adjust it. And, okay, maybe this one is wider, this one is tighter. You make choices. Maybe I need a close-up. This close-up is more important, so I have this camera wider, this camera tighter. You know, so it's once you're setting it up, you have a general idea how to do it. And then you massage it, and by the time you're all, you have it. And if you don't have it, then you still adjust up to take one. It's like, sorry, guys.
Mr. Getty, your grandson, he's been kidnapped.
To the people who took him,
I ask as a mother to set my boy free.
Yes.
$17 million to release him.
I don't have any money.
Get it from your father-in-law. He has all the money in the world.
I just rewatched All the Money for my fourth time the other night. And what I think is obviously something to address is your process with the reshoots where Chris Plummer replaced a previous actor just 8 weeks before the Christmas release. That's something that no matter what is going to go down in history. Could you just quickly take me through what it took on your end and your department to organize those days of additional photography? Because how does your approach evolve when maybe... in the only time in your life, you're going to get to go back and reshoot the exact same scene you were photographing just a few months before. Is that a chance for you to do it again, but better? Do you get new ideas?
Well, there are two ways. First of all, movie was completely cut. So we were not altering the film. So you analyze the scene and you see what you need. So in certain scenes, okay, that's it. We need a wide shot. We need a medium shot. We need a couple overs. So it's basically you follow the cut. And when the movie is cut, you can see it's pretty simple. So those scenes were very obvious. Then there were scenes, there was a scene against the fireplace with, I mean, Kevin and Mark Wahlberg. And those scenes were just reshot completely because it's just like, why bother plugging it in? Because when you have just two people talking, you know, this interaction and stuff. So pretty much the same coverage, maybe a little different. So there's like three or four scenes like this would be fully reshot. But like it's when it's seen at a big table with Michelle, we've never reshot Michelle because Michelle was so good at that scene with Kevin. So we just kept Michelle.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you kept her coverage.
We kept the cover from so she was acting to Kevin. Yeah. And so we just did wide shots over her back. Of course she was there, you know. But her coverage, her performance we kept because plus also it would be unfair to her. She's done such an amazing job. You know what I mean? So for her to come back to be there emotionally and stuff when we were basically just surgically plugging things in.
Oh, it speaks to how methodical both you and Ridley are. You know, we started talking about him doing drawings for specific shots and you just followed that.
It's actually easy because there's no discussion. It's pretty obvious. That's what you have to do. Maybe here, let's just do this. Maybe some extra, but basically, yeah. Then there was a scene with a kid in the fancy hotel. We reshot the whole scene, yeah. The whole scene. Wish we did the whole scene. Then there was a scene in Jordan with a train. And then, because we could not go to Jordan, it would be too crazy. So
you shot on a green screen, right?
We literally green screen plugged them into the... We built a little bit of a piece of a train in England, foggy, complete. Actually, I felt hate lighting exteriors, but I had to light exteriors just to make it look like sunny Jordan or whatever, Saudi Arabia. So we just had a piece of him stepping off the train. And then all the Saudi actors, you know, they were from the previous scene. And a big, 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 big wide shot was Kevin.
It's a good day.
Glad to hear that, Mr. Getty. It'll make this much easier. We need to pay the ransom.
I thought you said this was a hoax.
Your grandson was kidnapped by members of the Calabrese 'Ndrangheta. Two of the original kidnappers are dead. One is missing.
That sounds like progress to me.
I'm afraid not, right? They got nervous waiting for the ransom. They sold the boy to an investor.
An investor? Who invests in kidnapped children?
Well, you'll be surprised. There's nothing people can't find a way to turn into money. These people are not the old world Malavita anymore. Their only code is profit and loss. They will do things to Paul that cannot be undone for any amount of money. We have to pay.
This simply isn't possible. My financial position has changed.
Really? I mean, 30 seconds ago, you said it was a good day. With oil up as much as it was this morning, you have amassed another fortune.
Well, what if the embargo is lifted and oil were to crash, I'd be exposed. I have never been more vulnerable financially than I am right now.
Mr. Getty, with all due respect, nobody has ever been richer than you are at this moment.
I have no money to spare.
What would it take? I mean, what would it take for you to feel secure?
More.
I just wanted to ask you about Napoleon. Filming began in February of 22. Continues all over Europe, and the film is going to feature major battle sequences. And given your experience on The Last Duel and the multi-camera approach that we talked about, what's your process usually when trying to cover these large battle scenes in a way that feels emotional, but you also have to worry, I'm sure, about geography and clarity and making sure the audience knows where the characters are in a big field?
There's technically three big battles. Battle of Tulum, when he becomes a general, when he defeats the English fleet in the beginning of revolution. Then there's quick battles, but they're not really, they were just like historical points, Marengo. Then there's a famous battle which shows his genius as a tactician, which was Austerlitz, when he sends the whole Russian and also Hungarian army into the lake. And of course, the last one is Waterloo. Yeah. I mean, Waterloo was of course the biggest because it's a lot of designing, a lot of thinking, just finding locations to accommodate that thing. Because those battles were played on huge, vast areas, probably non-existent without freeways and stuff anymore. So Austerlitz was a combination of two locations. One was the forest, which is a hill, and the bottom of the hill was completely redone. We actually shot it on the old airport that we could snow it in and art direct it, because we just need a huge, vast, flat area. And also, the tricky part about those battles is that it's not a story about some brave soldier who goes in with a sword and beats everybody. You know, he had moments like this, but basically it's about him being a tactician. So a lot of those battles are very brutal, but more picturesque painterly from a distance about what's going on. It's interesting. And, you know, we can only have like 80 horses and 300 soldiers, which is quite a lot if you have them full gallop and stuff. But, you know, all the big ones have to be digitally enhanced there.
When you're doing a war film, the scale of everything is so massive. I wanted to do it all in one go. I'd have 300 men, 100 horses, and 11 cameras in the field. It was amazing because you've actually reconstructed the real thing. I started to think, like Napoleon, that influence can be great or it can be deadly.
I follow in the footsteps of Alexander the Great and Caesar. I'm destined for greatness.
I can imagine, as you're talking about picking locations, it's also about working with your location managers. Not only what fits the look of a scene best, but maybe a location doesn't work for a number of reasons because it's going to be an impediment in terms of your resources, your camera choices, and that's what makes you decide on specific ones.
Well, it's also a lot of limitations in terms of, you know, movie business has become so huge that what we were able to do, still with permits illegally, but that was okay to do like 20 years ago, and now it's very different. I mean, opening of Austerlitz, actually, it's played in the top of the battle. I mean, Napoleon's camp is staged in the same place that they shot Gladiator, that he could just do the huge battle scene, but now we could not do this, we could not do that, we could not go this way because of environmental reasons, because of that. So it was all of a sudden, he has invented this location. It's happened to be our from London, which is very convenient for producers, and everyone used it after Gladiator. So by the time we showed up again, we just cannot do this, cannot do that, which is kind of funny. But that's a totally different aspect of cinema. It's just logistics and location people and regulations and what they tell you that you can and that all of a sudden you cannot. Napoleon was very hard. Also, everything was natural location. So we were, you know, shooting in 17th, 18th century estates. So difficulties about like fireplaces, candlelight, had to be very, very carefully planned or designed. And yeah, very hard.
Well, you mentioned using a location from the original Gladiator, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I would imagine you're close to start preparing the new Gladiator film.
Actually, I'm not involved in it.
Oh, really?
I'm not. It's a very simple reason that, you know, I took the movie after Napoleon and I didn't know that it was going to go so fast. So it would be impossible for me. It would be just making another movie back to back. And it's just time to spend with my family. And it was the hardest decision I had to make.
No, I fully understand. I mean, then let me ask you the final question specifically, you know, about that. I am grateful as an audience member and amazed at the speed and efficiency that not only Ridley but yourself have jumped from project to project to project. I mean, we haven't even talked about the fact that House of Gucci was born out of COVID happening and you guys wanting to do more and preparing new things. So how do you think the absence of long periods of pause and meditation, you have been going back to back for a very long time, and I wonder if sometimes that gives you extra creative momentum.
Well, it was a fantastic run with Ridley. Literally, we did 9 movies back to back. And I mean, I squeezed you in between still. But it just got to the point that I just think you have to stop for a second. And I think if you stop and if you don't work for a while, then you get more anxious and you have to rejuvenate yourself. It's simple as that. You know, your muscles have to rest for a minute. Yeah. So that's what I did.
And there you have it, folks. Thank you to Darius for calling in to record this episode. To the team at Iconic Talent Agency for setting the conversation up. And of course to Eric for taking care of the final mixing. Darius's new film, Napoleon, opens in theaters November 22nd. If you are a fan of cinematography, feel free to check out our previous episodes with Shelley Johnson, Jan de Bont, Salvatore Totino, along with Oscar nominees John Schwartzman and Dan Lauschten, and Oscar winner Eric Messerschmidt, whose new film Ferrari also opens later this year. I'm Brando Benetton, and you have been listening to soundstage access.